This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How important these days is it to finish school, to get to year 12? How important was it for you? Did you get by and even thrive when you were dropping out early? But have things changed? I'd love to hear your story. This is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Almost one in five kids in Australia drop out before year 12 for lots of different reasons. Has your child dropped out? Tell me your story. Tell me why your child might have dropped out and how that has affected them. And you. We'll dig into what's happening for students these days and what needs to be done. Is it a worry? One in five, almost, don't get to year 12. Also today.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Do we even like birthdays in this age of social media? Not because we're squeamish about our age, no, but because there's so much pressure for them to be an event, to be curated and promoted on social media. I'm going to be talking to someone today who says it's quite binary. We either love birthdays, we love lapping up the attention, or we prefer just a little bit less fuss, maybe because social media these days has raised expectations. If we don't get the champagne and the curated good times, that can actually make us feel lonely, even if we're not particularly lonely. Where are you on this binary scale, if it exists? Are you on a binary scale? Do you love birthdays, or are you a bit off them because they've become performance art? If you love birthdays and you've got a loved one who doesn't love them, how do you deal with that? How do you manage it? Or maybe it's vice versa. You don't love them, but you need to put something on. I'd love to hear your story. We'll talk about birthdays. Have they become performance art? And tell me, have you been someone who dropped out of year 12? Tell me how that might have affected your life. And is it a worry that almost one in five kids are dropping out in Australia? Also, it's that time of year. We'll learn what the tax office is zeroing in on. But next, how important is it to finish year 12?
This is the Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Tell me, if you dropped out, are you glad you did, or do you regret it? It's something that almost one in five kids are facing these days. Joining me now is Rebecca Colley, who's Professor of Learning Sciences at Monash University, who can tell us all about the data. Thank you for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks, Mary.
What does the data show?
Yeah, so look, the latest government data this year shows that around 81.5% of students go on to complete school from year 10. And this did increase slightly from last year. It's up 1.6 percentage points. So we're seeing a slight increase, but not much of a change. And these figures have largely been stable for a long while now. And what it does mean, as you said, is that one in five year 10 students does not complete school.
Does not complete school. Some people on text are not liking the term dropout. And I guess, Rebecca, that does go to something here in terms of how it's perceived. What is the situation these days when it comes to not completing year 12?
So there are many different pathways, more nowadays than they have been in the past, which is really terrific. As students have different goals and priorities. However, we do know that school completion does keep the widest range of post-school options open, from vocational training to direct work entry or even to tertiary study. And we also know that the outcomes associated with finishing school are significant, things like better employment prospects, stronger health and wellbeing, just to name a few.
Steph, you've called from Ballarat. What do you think?
Look, I just wanted to call out the language choice that you're making with saying dropping out of school, because my son has recently made a choice to leave school and he's doing an apprenticeship and really succeeding. And I think that he's had to defend that choice a little bit because of the language around dropping out.
Fair point, Steph.
And I think if we focused more around the opportunities that are coming from that, and his health and well-being has improved significantly because of the choice that he's made successful in getting a job, and it's a really good thing for him.
Tell me why he didn't, why he made that decision, Steph, and why it's so much better for him now.
Oh, look, he had definitely some learning challenges. Gilbert was supported around those, but he's an active young man that likes to be outdoors, and the school environment, he was turning up, he was present at school and not as engaged as what, you know, I think is a productive way to be at school. And him choosing to leave, he's so engaged, and he's, I think his growth as a person, and he's way more mature, and it's been a huge step in the right direction for him.
Oh, Steph, that's really good to hear, and thank you for ringing in and calling me out on that language. It just dropped into my sentence, which is shameful for me, but I guess does say something, Rebecca. You're listening to Rebecca Colley, who's from Monash University, and digging into this data. What would you have to say about Steph's experience there? I mean, at what point do we think that it is a worry for a child to make that decision in conjunction with their, hopefully, their supportive adults as well, and when it isn't a good thing?
It's a really good point, and for a lot of students it's the right thing to do. When they have great opportunities that they want to pursue, when school isn't right for them, it's an excellent choice. But in some cases there are students who at some point along the way they've become disengaged or disconnected from school, and there are things that schools can do to make sure that they don't leave if that's not really what they want to do but they feel that they have to.
What are some of the things that the schools can do?
Yeah, so look, there's some really good research on what schools can do to help students who want to stay within schools, to keep them continuing. Things like the teaching approaches. And so these are the teaching strategies that help students learn effectively. Students need to feel that they can succeed. Every learner needs to feel that they are making progress in order to stay engaged and connected at school. And so that's things like reducing difficulty when students are starting a new topic so that they have that sense that they can succeed. Mm. And another one we see is classroom organisation or classroom management. And this is how teachers structure the classroom, how they build positive interactions for learning within that classroom. And we know that orderly, predictable classrooms can free students up to focus on learning rather than navigating disruption.
Mm. Yep. Yeah, I was just going to say, John from Tokenwall has called in. What did you want to say, John?
I don't take an apprentice once they go past year 10. Now, I've had seven over the years, because at 16 years of age, they don't have a licence. They can't go to the hotel or a nightclub. They haven't discovered girls. So you have 2 years to cram them with information to make them good mechanics before that all happens. And every one of the seven that I've had went on to be successful mechanics.
So in your view, that's not just a good decision.
They're not dropouts. They're successful human beings.
Thanks, John. That's a really good point. Thank you for calling. Rebecca, what do you think about that notion? Of course, that underlines these different pathways that a lot of kids choose.
It does, absolutely. And it's similar to the previous caller where we're hearing these really great opportunities. And it's wonderful that students do have these different pathways. And again, back to my point, when they don't want to leave but they feel they have to, that's where schools can step into the system.
What would you like to see to bring us, you know, up to a point? And I guess what sort of data would you like to end at? Is one in five not that bad then, or do you think it captures some of the people who leave just because there's no support? What sort of figure is acceptable?
Yeah, look, I don't know if I can put a number, but I do agree with you that if there are students within that cohort that are leaving school early but they don't want to, then anything we can do to help them stay is important. And some of those strategies I mentioned are key. We also know that strong relationships with teachers are really important. They help students feel that sense of connectedness, that sense of belonging to school. And when students don't have that, it's very hard to want to stick around and want to complete school.
Mm. Michael, you're in Benalla. What did you want to say?
I just wanted to weigh in from somebody that left school at a younger age. I left at the age of 15. I think I was 4 or 5 weeks into year 10. And it wasn't because I didn't like school or I wasn't good at school. I guess my story is probably different to everybody else's, but I'm now 43 and a multiple business owner, multiple property owner, and I put that down to doing a trade at an early age, and engaging in adult conversations and talking to people from different walks of life that gave me a lot of advice that I would never have got at school.
Yeah. So from your point of view, Michael, you just like that to be the message for people who make that decision?
Yeah, look, I took on an apprenticeship and my parents said to me, you start it, you finish it. So by the time I finished it, I was 19 and at a young age, I guess, in an adult world, but I'd also travelled overseas on my own dollar.
Yeah. So you don't feel it's cut off any of the pathways ahead in your life, Michael?
From my journey, being at school or having a piece of paper that said I'd completed year 12 has never, ever been a prerequisite for a job. It's never been asked about. I've never had to prove it. I've just told my story as when I left and what my level of education was, and it's had really no implications in my life whatsoever.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much for bringing us that story, because I can see that experience also reflected on text. Rebecca Colley is still on the line. We've got all of those positive stories, Michael, is included, Rebecca. But this is well on text. A 26-year-old here, dropped out at 15. I regret leaving so early and should have stuck it out. I still lived a good life and I'm full of a lot of life knowledge, but should have stayed in school and I would feel as if I have more life pathways. It's hard to reconcile, isn't it, if you're a child or a young adult or a parent as to which is going to be the better path ahead. What do you think that people should be asking themselves in order to make that decision?
Yeah, it comes down to their individual situation and what options they'd like to remain open to them. So if they can stick around at school, make sure they get some better support perhaps they aren't receiving, but find ways to receive that support or ask for more support, then that opens up more pathways, as we just heard. But for others, it's the right thing to do, and we've heard some really great stories about success, irrespective of whether they completed school or not.
Rebecca, where is your next area of research here? What do you think that you'll be concentrating on?
So one thing that we're really interested in is the role of, you know, providing these supports earlier on, because if we want to shift those numbers for the students who do want to continue and complete school, if we want to increase the chances for them, then we need to start early. So for high school students, that's right at the start of year 7, and we do know from research that that can make a difference for them.
Yeah. Rebecca Colley, I think this conversation has highlighted how individual the decision is. Thank you for digging into the data for us.
Thanks, Mary.
That's Rebecca Colley, who's Professor of Learning Sciences at Monash University. This on text, Mary, my son dropped out a direct result of lockdown and homeschooling. He's still picking up the pieces. He went from a well-socialised, happy kid to someone who feels isolated or alone. They said, I'm so proud of him and his efforts in self-improvement. That's good to hear. Best wishes to that texter as well. And also, though, this from Sam in Kyneton saying, my son made a conscious decision to leave school at the end of year 11 to take up an apprenticeship. He's well ahead in life than many of his peers who stayed in school until the end of year 12. That's what we're talking about today. How important is it to finish year 12? Also, what we're talking about today, do we like birthdays? It's apparently a binary question. We will talk about that. Has social media ruined it? We will also touch on a great comeback you might have heard of, one of the best athletes of all time, Serena Williams, 44, about 4 years since she last picked up a racket in anger. We're going to get someone's perspective who should know about what is at stake for that comeback. But next, it is that time of year. What is the ATO going to be targeting when you make up your tax return?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We will be talking Serena, we will be talking birthdays. Do you love them? Do you hate them? Are you off social media because you don't want that pressure? But next, ATO Assistant Commissioner Anita Challen is joining us to talk about what the tax office might be peering over your shoulder and particularly looking at when you make your return this year. Thanks for joining us, Anita.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me.
We will get to more general questions about what you're targeting, but just first off, I wanted to ask you about something that's probably on a lot of our listeners' minds, the recent property tax changes. How will they affect this year's return?
Yeah, understandably, it's a question everyone's asking, Mary, and as you'd appreciate, the changes are a matter for government. So whilst it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment on those, what I can say is that the measures are not yet law, which means they won't apply for this year's tax returns. Mm-hmm. It's always a good idea to keep good records and seek advice from a verified source if you need to. But the good news is no significant changes this year when you lodge your tax return.
And it'll be next year?
So it depends, and as I mentioned, matters for government that are still being discussed at the moment.
Right, it does depend. They are still nutting out some of those carve-outs, as we know. So that's a TBC. What we do know is that you are looking through a particular lens this year at people's returns. What are you targeting?
Yeah, so this year our focus remains on work-related expenses and, of course, working from home deductions. We're also reminding taxpayers to ensure that they report all their income, including any extra income that they might make from things like online platforms, the sharing economy, investments, or of course those occasional cash jobs as well.
Mm. So that's the working from home aspect. I believe you're also looking at private expenses that don't really qualify. What are some of the examples of what you're going to be looking at?
Yeah, so most people try and do the right thing, but we do certainly see our fair share of people attempting to claim deductions that they're just not entitled to. And we do continue to have an eye on work-related expenses and working from home deductions. The areas that we see people continuing to make the most errors are where they might just overclaim, not apportioning to account for private use versus work-related use, and not keeping the right records, which is always an important aspect of when you want to claim a deduction, you need to make sure you've got those receipts to substantiate those claims.
What are some of the craziest things that you've seen being claimed as work expenses that are not?
Yeah, we do see a bit of a range. So some recent examples are where a taxpayer looked to claim almost $17,000 in baby expenses for newborn winter clothes, child expenses, medical expenses, and a fairly generous taxpayer who gifted $20,000 to send to family and tried to claim that in their tax return. So they are some things where, you know, important and nice things to be spending your money on, but not something that you should put in your tax return.
We also can't write off a baby. That's one of your top lines.
Right. Key message for everyone today, Mary. Absolutely. Yes.
I see that you've also talked about claims for Christmas novelty T-shirts for the Christmas party.
Yep, a bit of fun at work is always a good thing, but important to note that that is definitely a private expense and not something you can deduct through your tax.
You're listening to Anita Challen, who is the Tax Office Assistant Commissioner. We're talking about what the Tax Office is targeting this year. Anita, you talked about their parsing out what is used in personal use versus work use. What's a sort of an example of that? And what's the sort of guiding principle when it comes to that for people?
Yeah, it's a really good question and it can get a little bit complicated, Mary, particularly if you look at, as an example, your working from home deductions. So for a lot of us as employees, if we're just going into the office and working as we normally would, there's not a lot we can claim. When you start working from home, of course, there's the option if you're incurring additional expenses to claim those. But if, for example, you're using your internet for work purposes, but you've also got the kids downloading things on the weekend or you're using your streaming services for other things, you do need to make sure that you're only claiming the portion of that expense that relates to when you're actually working from home and you keep the private expenses out of your tax return.
And do you need to keep a log of all those times? Is it in time portions?
Yeah, look, there's a couple of methods you can use. The easiest way and the one that cuts through that apportionment complexity is our fixed rate method, and that allows you to claim 70 cents for every hour that you work from home. And you do need to just keep a version of each of the bills that you're claiming for. So that might include your internet, mobile and home phone usage, electricity or gas. If you decide to use the actual cost method, you can certainly do that, and that might be a better way for you to do it. But there are some additional records that you need to keep to make sure that you've got the receipts of those actual costs you've incurred.
Mm. Anita, I've read that the ATO uses AI. Presumably that's been happening for a little bit. Can you tell us how you do use it? You've said that it's to understand behaviour patterns. How does that work?
Yeah, so it definitely is the case that we use data and analytics and AI to help administer tax systems. It does help us to tailor services to get things right from the start. Mm. It means we can understand behaviour. An example of where we might use some of this is for those of you lodging online, using our online services, people might see some prompts and things like that that kind of say, hey, this looks a bit odd in terms of your occupation, or we might be able to give some important education or communication direct to clients by using AI and automation, and that can be really helpful to make sure that taxpayers can get it right the first time.
How does it actually detect problems?
So we usually apply it to broader population and behaviours. It can help us combat and reduce fraud. Of course, we always have human oversight where we're making decisions that ultimately impact a taxpayer. So if you've got a decision that's going to impact you as a taxpayer, you can be assured that that's being made by a real person.
Yep. And just finally, Anita, where can people turn to if they need to get advice?
Look, the best place for taxpayers to get verified tax advice is either through the ATO website, the ATO app, or of course through a registered tax agent as well.
Anita, thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much, Mary.
That's Anita Challen, who is an ATO Assistant Commissioner. Good luck with everyone looking at that as we all hurtle towards that time. You're on The Conversation Hour with 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. My name's Mary Gear, and I tell you, one of the biggest names of all time is making a comeback after about 4 years off the court. 44-year-old Serena Williams is back. Let's talk next about the art of the comeback.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So Serena Williams hasn't raised a racket in anger since the 2022 US Open, but this morning she confirmed that she is coming back to tennis. Joining me now is Roger Rashid, veteran tennis coach and player as well. Thanks for joining us, Roger.
No problems, Mary. Nice to be on.
Were you surprised by this?
I was surprised. I'm a veteran. I feel old now. Now you talked about Serena, 44.
But esteemed. I'll go with esteemed.
That's okay. Yeah. Anyway, I'll take anything. I'm still breathing. Hey, was I surprised? I guess not really, in the sense that at the end of last year, I think she put herself back under the protocols of being a professional athlete on the tennis tour, where she had to nominate where her whereabouts were just in regards of being able to be drug tested, et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to enter the back onto the tennis tour, you've got to be part of that system. So once you, I guess, nominate to put yourself back into that space, it seems like there's obviously a story that's going to be told. Mm. And everyone was thinking that maybe Serena would look at coming back and playing doubles with her sister Venus, and I'll finish their career together at the US Open, for example, in August, September. But looks like she might have some bigger fish to fry still in her mind.
Right. Well, that's the question, isn't it? As your high-performance coach and consultant, what do you believe is behind this sort of audacious comeback attempt? Why would she be doing this?
Oh, look, it's very hard when you're an athlete, I think, that you finally can just sort of shut shop, and tennis is an individual sport, so you're not in a team environment, so it's all about you, and you know, when you do finish, you know, what's what's next? Where do you get that buzz from, that adrenaline from? And obviously watching, has another child. You know, Mary, when you finish playing your career, sometimes you actually get in better condition than you were when you were, because it's not the daily grind that your body's taken, the travel and all the energy that's associated with being a professional tennis player all around the globe. So, you know, she's always stayed in good shape. Been hitting a lot of balls lately. We've seen that. And so she looks in great condition. Mm. And she's got a game which is sustainable to the modern game. She's a big power hitter, a huge serve, one of the best serves the game's ever seen on the women's side of the game. And so she's probably looking back and seeing, I'm watching Elena Svetolina, who's in the quarterfinals of the French Open, who's married to Gael Monfils. She's had a child. She's come back even better. Naomi Osaka's had a child and has come back and just lost overnight to Sabalenka. But why not put myself out there again? Mm. And I guess there's an appetite for it. She'll start off playing doubles at Queen's Club, which will be really exciting. And then who knows whether that transitions to a singles spot. We're probably waiting at the moment to see whether Wimbledon announce something in the coming weeks of whether there's a wild card that's been given to Serena. I guess that's the next path we're going to look at.
Mm. You're listening to Roger Rashid, high performance sports consultant, former international tennis coach. We're talking about the much anticipated and now announced move by Serena Williams to come back. What do you think about that? Are you looking forward to it? Roger, you said why not do it? I mean, I'm certainly not going to bet against one of the all-time greatest athletes. But what is at stake? What if it's a bust? What does that do to her psyche, her legacy?
So, I think her legacy's already set.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that.
When you're
the greatest Grand Slam winner, you know, major champion. So I think the legacy's there. The excitement piece is that, you know, we see them gracing the court again and seeing what's possible. So If it was Serena Williams and her tennis game was structured purely around how athletic she was, how much speed she needed, you'd actually be questioning that, thinking, gee, as you get older, you don't actually get faster and you don't, you know, you sort of lose that attribute. So, but that's not, her game's not needed. It's not designed around that. So she's a beauty, a big, pure ball striker. And as I said, with her power game, she can stay relevant in the competition. Now, will she win a major again? Mm. I don't think she's going to win a major. No, I think she's far from that. But I would see her, she would be watching and thinking, hey, I could be very competitive and maybe have, you know, could I have one run where I make the second week of a major and there's that adrenaline back in, you know, that I've yet to experience for a while. So, yeah. Oh, look, I think we're all sitting there, Marion, going, oh, this, it's exciting for the game, another storyline.
Exactly.
And, you know, and why not?
No matter what happens. Roger, really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, no worries.
Roger Rashid, high-performance sports consultant, former international tennis coach. Tell me whether you're looking forward to having Serena back. No matter what you think of her, she is certainly one to watch always. It is the Conversation Hour, and later we are going to be talking about whether the compensation that the federal government is offering if you have been scammed, you get an automatic $3,000. Is that actually good enough? We'll talk to someone who's looked abroad to see how it compares. Also, I want to ask you, do you care about birthdays, and does social media kind of wreck it for you? 1300 222 774. But I also did want to remind you of 774's Meals for Melbourne. We've been talking about that this week. It's a good old-fashioned food drive. We're giving food through Food Bank to people who are doing it tough, and you can drop off non-perishable food items at the cafe here in South Bank at the ABC at 120 South Bank Boulevard is the address. Things like veggies, cans of veggies or soup or packets of pasta or rice. So if you can't actually do that, there's a virtual food pantry as well. And the way to get a link to that food pantry, or for more information, you can text MEAL, M-E-A-L, to 0437 774 774. The number again, 0437 774 774, MEAL, M-E-A-L. And you can get those details. Next, do you even like birthdays these days?
This is the Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy
What does that song do for you? Does it make you cringe or do you love it? Do we care about birthdays or has social media just kind of ruined it for us all? How do you celebrate birthdays for people who just don't want the fuss? I'd love you to join me in conversation. Also in conversation with my guest today who says this is a binary thing. We either love birthdays, and we lap up the attention, or we don't, and maybe social media is to blame. Melissa Hoyer is a writer and pop culture commentator who wrote a piece on this for The Age, and she joins me now. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning, Mary. Happy birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy non-birthday, potentially, if we're feeling that way. I must admit, Melissa, I found myself agreeing with you wholeheartedly when I read this. Did you think I was going to be one of those people who just loved the Instagram reels?
Well, I do have a couple of threads who are exactly that. So, you know, literally at the beginning of the year, they're already looking forward to how they're going to celebrate their birthday in the following December. But I am so the opposite. And it's funny, Mary, it's not sort of, it's not the age thing. I think, you know, we all know how old we are, and that's life. But it's just this sort of expectation of, oh, so what are you up to today? I bet you've got a really big thing planned. And I actually said, it did happen to be my birthday last week. And someone texted that to me early in the morning, and it's a lovely friend, but I went, no, I've actually got nothing planned. And then I felt like I was sort of the, oh, woe is me. I was feeling sorry for myself. But it wasn't that at all. It was just a matter of, it's just another day. It comes, it goes. And, you know, I'm not someone to say, okay, well, in 4 weeks' time, it's my birthday. Let's all get together.
And let's have a celebration of me.
That's right. And I think it's that element of, I mean, everyone's got their own stuff going on in life at the moment. So to add another thing into it and say, don't forget, in 4 weeks' time, let's celebrate me. No.
Do you agree with Melissa and myself, or are we just birthday Grinches? Let me know. That's right. We birthday cake curmudgeons. Or do you love getting on and just sharing the love of your birthday? Maybe this is self-deprecation gone too far between us, Melissa. Maybe we're not putting ourselves forward enough.
Yeah, because I love celebrating other. I mean, I'll go to everyone's birthday and sing and do all that and put the money into the present and really, really happy. But I think it's this self-deprecating thing, you know, having, you know, I grew up in a really, really sort of normal sort of working class household, didn't have the big grand birthdays. And I think, you know, when you look at social media and sometimes you see these, you know, extraordinary events that people put on or put on for friends, and they are brilliant and great.
And good on them.
I love that, love it. But just for me to sort of say, okay, let's go and have a birthday dinner for me and we'll all put in a couple of $100 and do it, is just not me. And I don't, you know, it's just something that's innate and it doesn't worry me at all about birthdays.
That's right. And if it is binary and you're someone who loves it but you're with someone who doesn't, let me know how you get along in your household. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Kai, you've called from Colac. How are you on this spectrum?
I'm all for it.
You're all for the birthdays.
Oh, absolutely. And I think especially celebrating your own birthday.
It is
the anniversary of the day that you were brought into existence, and I think it's actually a sacred day that we should all sort of recognize and take time to sort of celebrate.
Kai, that is fantastic. But a question is: do you put it on social media? Do you also feel that that's sharing the love and the celebration of your life?
I think that's an individual choice, but personally, no. But I don't see any issue with that. If someone wants to express their sort of, you know, the recognition of a birthday or their own, I think, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, Kai, absolutely. I think the undercurrent of this is live and let live, and each to their own. Thank you. Jill, you've called from East Malvern. How do you feel about birthdays?
Well, I personally am not interested in celebrating my birthday publicly. It's another day to me, but it's the same with my wedding anniversary. I mean, we often forget, because it's in December, we often forget that it's there, and someone will ring up and say, oh, it's your wedding anniversary. But I'm happy to make an effort to celebrate my grandchildren's birthdays or something like that. And I also probably, I was lucky, I turned 70 during COVID, so I couldn't have to have a birthday party.
That was a good thing for you, Jill.
It was. My daughter was desperately trying to think of something amazing to do for me, and I was, no, thanks, I'm fine. So there you go.
I mean, it's a good problem to have loved ones, isn't it, Jill? But it's hard to convince them that, you know, this is not me putting myself down. I just won't bother the fuss.
Well, next year my husband is about to turn 80.
And how does he feel?
He's already talking about, let's have a great big birthday party for my 80th birthday. And all I can think of is, I'll be doing all the work.
I think monumental birthdays, I think that is, you know, if it's 70, 80, 60, 50, but when it's just sort of a non-monumental birthday, I'm really happy for just a slide by.
Slide by. Look, Jill, I hope you don't get lumbered with too much of it. Thank you so much for calling in. This as well from Chris in Geelong. I agree with, I think it's you and me, Melissa, on our birthdays, my wife and I prefer a quiet visit to a favourite restaurant, maybe with a friend and nothing more. We're not into wasting money. But this is well on text from Karen. I think the opposite. Birthdays have lost their importance and individuality. We have an extended family WhatsApp, which is great to keep in touch. And although we all send out messages for birthdays, I reckon it's all a bit robotic. I used to send cards, which we all love receiving, and actually call the person. Now it's a quick message and we move on. I don't do book face, says Karen. It's ruined us. Melissa, you tell the story also of getting messages from people on LinkedIn. You don't even know.
And this is awful because, you know, again, it's making me sound like a curmudgeon. But so I got a whole lot of lovely, happy, robotic, happy birthday, Melissa, direct DMs on LinkedIn from people I've never, ever, ever, ever met in my entire life. But I had more messages from that particular platform than probably real life. And so, you know, as your texter just said, and I'm the same with a family WhatsApp. I mean, on the morning, I got, happy birthday, Melissa, have a nice day. Happy birthday, have a nice day. There's no feeling. And we all do it. So, you know, we're not putting anyone down. But, you know, there is that sort of robotic thing that happens now because we are so able to use so many platforms, whether it is WhatsApp, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You know, there's so many things we can use in order to sort of relay our wishes. But that said, it's kind of... It does take any real, real innate joy out of what, you know, it should be a day that you want to spend how you want to spend. Mm. And I was really happy last week just to do nothing. But that was my choice. It wasn't sort of thrust upon me. It was just like, you know what? I just want to have a day in my pajamas. It was freezing cold in my pajamas, watching, you know, streaming something. And that was that. You know, that was my idea of heaven.
Melissa, it's pretty close to mine as well. Thank you so much for kicking off this conversation today. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure, Mary. Speak soon.
Melissa Hoyer is writer and pop culture commentator. Yes, I think we've just all settled on, well, if we're going to celebrate it, at least make it meaningful. And Danny might have had the best last word on this. Birthday's very lucky. The more that you have, the longer you live. You are listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Next, I'm going to talk about the new scheme from the federal government proposing automatic refunds of up to $3,000 for scam victims. Now, that sounds pretty generous, but in the UK, it's closer to $160,000. So are we serious enough about scams?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Keep those texts and calls coming if you'd like about birthdays. Many different celebratory approaches there. I love to hear all about it. Is it pajamas or is it the Insta reel? What works for you? But next, let's talk about the scam compensation scheme that the federal government recently announced. Paul Haskell-Doland, and I'm sorry if I've gotten that wrong, Professor of Cybersecurity Practice at Edith Cowden University, thinks that the recently announced scheme is perhaps not as ambitious as it first appears, and he joins me now. Hi, Paul.
A very good morning to you.
At $3,000, look, we all thought that seems pretty good because it might be less than that and we'll clean up some more. Why are you arguing that it's beginning to look a little inadequate?
So first of all, let's just say absolutely bringing something in like this is a positive move. It will be great for consumers. It will help fraud victims to be able to recover, hopefully, some of their losses, perhaps even all of them. But when you consider that we have $2 billion worth of losses reported to government agencies in 2025, and the ScamWatch data shows that investment scams had a combined loss of over $162 million, with a median loss of $7,000, then only a small proportion of those losses would actually be reimbursed under this new scheme. Mm. And compared to the UK model, which has a £85,000 refund opportunity, it does seem to be set quite low. So I think there's work to be done, and certainly it's a move in the right direction, but I think the threshold could be set a little bit more ambitiously.
Should we be thinking about $160,000 like the UK?
I really wouldn't recommend that, and the data wouldn't really support it. So the biggest losses are, on average, no more than $10,000 to $15,000. So setting a threshold so high would potentially actually remove the easy opportunity to be able to investigate some of the more expensive losses. So this new scheme would be a more automated process. There'd still be a burden of proof. There would still be a need to demonstrate you've taken due diligence, but it wouldn't necessarily involve a more formal investigation. And we don't want to take away that option for some of those higher value crimes. We want to make life easier for people, but we still want to make sure that we're suitably investigating cybersecurity incidents like this.
You're listening to Paul Haskell-Dowland, who is from the Edith Cowan University. We're talking about scams and the compensation scheme that the federal government has recently announced. What do you think? $3,000 for automatic compensation? Should it be higher? Tell me if you or someone you know has been scammed, and if we think that that's the responsibility, well, of all of us. Is it bad luck? Is it bad actors? Let me know what you think. Paul, when we talk about the difference between the UK and here, one major difference is that the Australian proposal brings in scams through telcos and digital platforms, cryptocurrency, I think, as well. The UK scheme is much narrower. So is it better in that sense?
To a certain extent, yes. And it is interesting that they have shared the blame or shared the responsibility across a number of key partners. So in the UK, it is the sending and receiving bank that are responsible for the payment. So should a individual make a claim of a scam incident that they've been affected by, then they wouldn't be recovering those losses, for example, from social media platforms. So it is quite different in the approach. And I think it is actually quite a positive move, because one of the benefits of this type of scheme, which shifts the onus on reimbursement to organisations to basically refund victims, means that they will begin to take even more seriously, and I don't want to downgrade what has already happened, the changes that have happened in industry to better protect us against scams. There's terrific work being done. But ultimately, the risk of financial losses through this might push even more innovation, more developments, more investment into scam detections to prevent them from happening in the first place, and then scam investigations to try and recover as much as we can when the unfortunate does happen.
I guess people are pretty cynical, particularly when it comes to the platforms like Meta and Google and so forth. They, I believe, are arguing that compensation schemes make consumers less vigilant. Is there any evidence for that, or is that about avoiding liability?
So there's probably a bit of avoidance there, and certainly trying to push the responsibility elsewhere. But if we look towards the UK, the evidence, and it's still early days, but the evidence would indicate that the amount of money being claimed for reimbursement is not that great. So in the first 3 months, it was around about £27 million, so about $50 million. And that then grew to just over 100 million over the first 9 months of the scheme. So there's always a lag with getting this kind of data. Mm. When you consider that Australia has seen $2 billion worth of losses overall in 2025, even if we were seeing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of reimbursements, it's still only a fraction of the overall. So I don't think we're going to see a huge change in behaviours. And in the UK, they've actually seen a reduction in claims and reported incidents. So I think it's that the banks are now being more proactive in detecting and blocking fraudulent transactions. Consumers are more aware of the nature of scams, partly because they're now able to report them. It's on their radar. And I think we're just seeing a shift in behaviours overall.
Mm. Paul, this is coming in on text from Anna. If it's our fault, why should we get anything? Isn't this a no-fault system? Or is it a no-fault system? What would you have to say about the level of personal responsibility that we need to accept but also need to reject as a notion?
So I think there is always an element of personal responsibility. And whilst we haven't got all the details yet of what the Australian scheme will look like, it is likely to mirror the UK, where you have to demonstrate you've taken some due diligence yourself. So this isn't just carte blanche for people to ignore the warnings on the basis that you can always get your money back up to that $3,000 limit. So I think there will still be a requirement for personal vigilance. But the evidence, again, will show that people are being vigilant. And from the UK example, we've actually seen the number of incidents decrease. So I think it will have a positive effect. There is lots that individuals can do to be better protected and to be more aware. And even these conversations will increase people's awareness of these kinds of scams and crimes. So I sort of see an overall positive on this. Mm. And the only evidence we've got so far indicates that the introduction of these schemes changes behaviours. People are more vigilant, more aware, and the businesses impacted are actually being more proactive in stopping them in the first place.
Yes, and we will continue to cover this as they get more sophisticated. We need to learn even more. Paul, thank you for helping us learn a little bit more about the scheme.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you, Paul. Paul Haskell-Dowland is Professor of Cybersecurity Practice at Edith Cowan University. Peter in Warrnambool says, best watch out for the scammers scamming the scam refund. You are correct, Peter. We're also talking about whether social media has ruined birthdays. How do we feel about birthdays these days? Judith in Malvern East, how do you feel about birthdays these days?
Well, Mary, I was trying to think of how to respond in regards to that conversation. And I thought, you know, it's really lovely to make a day special, because otherwise, you know, every day just becomes the same.
Mm.
But I was thinking too, maybe in regards to presents, rather than give something to someone that they may not like, give flowers or a plant for the garden, or even make them something beautiful to eat. I think that's a lovely gift.
Judith, that is absolutely lovely. And you know what also I like? This is what I demand, I mean ask my kids to give me, a handmade card. That'll do.
Absolutely.
It seems really above and beyond these days. Judith, thank you. Rob in North Fitzroy, what do you think? Hello, Rob. How do you feel about birthdays?
I love birthdays. All my family always made handmade cards. In fact, when he was nine, my son made me a card saying, May the 4th be with you. It was my birthday.
Oh, fantastic.
That was 50 years ago. But I was doing a film clip. I designed film clips.
Mm.
And I was doing one for Bardo in the studio. And I was turning 60. And I didn't want anybody to know because everybody's so young. And so we had a break. And we went for lunch down the local pub. And during the lunch break, Bardo and Sophie Monk got up and sang Happy Birthday to Robbie. And I was, oh, no.
Hey, that's fantastic. Surely you weren't shy after that, Rob.
That was great.
Oh, fantastic. And how do you celebrate them now, Rob? Do you get other people to sing you happy birthday?
Yeah, not so many handmade. All of my sons still making handmade cards.
Oh.
And my wife, who is a fabulous sculptor, Ivana, she made the best handmade cards. They're just amazing. Yeah, and I've still got them all. It's fantastic.
Oh, Rob, in these days when Insta's taking over with all those curated images, what can beat a handmade card? Thank you, Rob. Thank you for everyone who's joined that conversation today. And this has been the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Thank you for joining me today. Have a wonderful birthday if it is your birthday today, and please enjoy it no matter what you are doing. You can listen again on the ABC Listen app and write to me at conversationhour@abc.net.au.